Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So we're talking about that Supreme Court decision, a 5-4 decision. It overturned the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, which was designed to limit the influence of big business and labor unions on elections. Joining us is Jeff Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University. Jeff, let me just go over the doctrines that this court decision apparently affirms here. Number one, corporations are people. Money equals speech. Therefore, there are really no limits to deliver money to political campaigns. Is that, first of all, a surprise? Is that where the law was going, or is this a reversal?
It's a tremendous reversal. Ever since 1907, Congress has said that you can limit corporate direct contributions, and ever since 1947, it said you can limit direct expenditures. So to reach this decision, the court not only had to repudiate that long-settled understanding, but also overturn precedents dating back to 1990. By any measure of judicial restraint, this has to qualify as judicial activism. They repudiated an act of Congress, overturned precedents, and all unnecessarily. They could have decided it on much narrower ground. So it's an extraordinarily broad and troubling opinion.
And I think to many Americans, it's counterintuitive. Listen to one of our listeners, Jeffrey.
Hi, this is Steve calling from Nashville, Tennessee. I don't understand this whole issue with the campaign finance. The First Amendment rights are for persons, United States citizens, not for corporations. Persons, United States citizens, are allowed to vote, not corporations. So why do we grant corporations the right to so greatly influence elections?
So, Jeffrey Rosen, if our listener was talking to Justice Scalia, what might he say in opposition to that argument?
Well, Justice Scalia would say that from the time of the founding, we've treated corporations as groups that have all sorts of natural rights and have protected them. But this is just an unconvincing argument. As Justice Stevens suggested, it's really economic populism that was the core of the understanding of people ranging from James Madison to Andrew Jackson. And it wasn't until the 1890s that the court said that corporations are people with full constitutional rights. That decision has very shaky roots. And as the listener suggests, it's a very good point that Justice Stevens actually made in the opinion, too. Why can't corporations vote if they have full First Amendment rights?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, but wasn't the die cast then in the 1890s when the corporations were declared to have rights similar to people?
The die wasn't totally cast because we then had a progressive era and a huge backlash against the conservative court that struck down the income tax and that struck down minimum wage and maximum hours laws. And then in the 1930s, after Franklin Roosevelt threatened to pack the court, the Supreme Court seemed to get the message and from 1930s till the present has gotten out of the business of this kind of economic judicial activism. And the question now, which is so fascinating, is for the first time since the 1930s, are we about to have a conservative court challenged by a popular Democratic president? I mean, the fact that Barack Obama had no compunction in challenging the court yesterday suggests that this may be on the verge of a really historic confrontation between the court and the White House.
You know, and this is the second administration for very different reasons. The Bush administration confronted the court on a lot of national security issues, so we're enshrining a real sort of competition between the branches of government here. I can see sort of the historical dimensions of this decision now that you explain it, Jeffrey Rosen. Let's talk a little bit about what the court's behavior looks like. 5-4 decision. Kennedy wrote the majority opinion. What does it mean about the dynamics of this Roberts court?
Well, it's very telling indeed. So when John Roberts came into office, he said at his confirmation hearings that he wanted to be an umpire who called balls and strikes, and then he gave a bunch of interviews to journalists afterward, including me, where he really said, I want to be a uniter, I want to have narrow, unanimous opinions and avoid divisions at all costs, I want to be like John Marshall. So many of us were really waiting to see whether he'd make good on that promise. And this is he failed a historic test in this case by that standard. He could have decided it more narrowly. And it's so interesting to see how angry the liberals feel. Justice Stevens, both in his passionate written dissent and also reading it from the bench yesterday, basically said this whole judicial restraint stuff is nonsense. We can't take you seriously anymore because you're not playing fair. So I really have to say that John Roberts had a historic choice here about what kind of chief justice he wanted to be. And he suggested that he's more interested, as he said in his separate opinion, in getting the law right than in actually caring about judicial restraint, collegiality, and unanimity.
And this sets up the possibility, if the court changes one or two justices again, that we may go back the other way, which has already happened in one iteration, and we're setting up for another one, right?
Well, it's true, except that the justices most likely to retire are liberals, who'd be replaced by liberals.
Right.
So unfortunately, we may have this just polarized combination, the four conservatives, four liberals, with Kennedy in the middle but leaning right for a long time. It's a kind of depressing prospect.
Let me take you in a totally different direction then. I mean, there are a lot of people who look at campaign finances and the participation of the electorate as the sort of counterweight and say that campaign finance reform was never in this domain anyway, that real campaign finance reform is what happened in the 08 election, where suddenly smaller and smaller contributors using digital technology really elevated the Obama campaign, and that's the antidote to corporate giving. It's increased small contributions and a larger participation by the electorate. Forget about these McCain-Feingold bills. What do you say to that?
You know, it might work for a presidential election when you've got a highly popular and charismatic leader with a national base, but I'm not sure that it works in a local election or a Senate election where incumbents really can swamp their opponents by using corporate money. Now, it's hard to predict exactly how this will play out. Right now, Democrats are unhappy, but you could imagine in 2 years General Motors running ads in Michigan praising Obama for the bailout. So the effects of this are, the partisan effects are not necessarily obvious, but the really scary prospect is the idea that you can have retaliation. So someone votes against a corporate interest, and the corporation just floods him with attack ads and supporting his opponent. Right now, there are disclosure requirements, but Clarence Thomas even questioned those, so you could even have anonymous corporate money that was supporting some people and attacking others.
But in theory, on the disclosure requirements, if they stick, does that mean we're going to have attack ads that end with brought to you by Exxon?
Right now, Exxon would be reluctant to do that because they would have to identify themselves. And the real question is the Senate and is Congress now going to have further disclosure requirements, actually forcing the CEO of Exxon to have his face appear on the ad before it runs? That's where the next part of the debate is going to run.
Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University. Thanks for a great discussion on the 5-4 Supreme Court decision that was handed down yesterday.